Like when you're auditing and then you have to take a meeting and you switch, you have to like, you know, get out of the code. You're like in the matrix, you know, like have dug for all this shit and then you have a meeting and you snap out of it.
Yeah.
And then to go back in, for me, it feels like, you know, you're going on a walk or on a hike. And then when you have to do anything else, you immediately go back to the starting point. But if you want to go back to where you were, you have to do the walk again.
Yeah. Yeah. No, 100%. Yeah. I mean, that's you're speaking my soul right there with that. Like, I have to basically audit at like starting at like 9 in the evening, and then audit until like 2 in the morning, because that's just when I don't have any meetings or anything like that, and that's when I can actually focus.
I think we've been yelling about for way too long. Let's see. Let's get into some of the topics that I had on here. So it's a pleasure to have you here, man. Can you please give us a little bit of an intro? I think most people here already know who you are and what you do, but just for those people who don't really know you, let us know what's your thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, first of all, before I talk about, you know, anything, glad to be here. Love the past episodes you did, especially the one with Patrick. So really glad that you've been doing this. Need to have something to listen to. So this is perfect. And yeah, happy to be here. So I guess basically just to give like the cliff notes, and then if you want to talk more about any specific thing, happy to, you know, go into more detail. I used to run a SaaS app, really tiny SaaS app, had like 12 users or something like this. And I used to do that on the side while I was a software engineer. Long story short, that business kind of blew up. Not in the right way. It didn't hockey stick. It just, for whatever reason. Yeah, it basically, we were building on top of Instagram. Instagram changed their like terms of service, stuff like that. Just kind of wiped out our whole application. That was right when Bitcoin crashed. Got interested in that. I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. I think... we should go look at what's happening over there, and basically got into, you know, started to read about this thing called Ethereum, smart contracts, stuff like that. And really from there, just got in, saw an opportunity to build a DeFi protocol, built one, had to launch it, had to get an audit, got an audit. The audit sucked. There was a bug. We thought funds were lost. We rescued the funds. And then we realized, hey, let's not have this experience for other folks. Let's go ahead and get into auditing ourselves. Let's do it the right way. And that was about 2 years ago.
Cool. Yeah, I think it's a very nice quick summary how to where you got to be. And one of the differentials that you do in auditing, I think you probably were the first one to come up with this model, or at least the only one to do it on more scalable size, is the paper vulnerability model.
Yeah.
Did you get that off of somewhere, or did you just kind of brainstorm it and think like, no one is doing this, why is no one doing this, let's do this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it pretty much came out of the experience that we had, where we had gotten an audit and it came back clean, like, you know, they sometimes do. And you know, this is something we're trying to change about the industry, is the thinking that if you get an audit, nothing comes back, then you're good. Of course, as we know, that's not the case. And now I certainly know that's not the case. And we ended up having to pay, like, we paid up front for that, right? And we paid, you know, a decent amount. It wasn't anything crazy. It wasn't like a top tier firm or anything like that, because, you know, we didn't raise any money for this or anything like that. But it was still a lot of money for us at the time. And we were like, wow, well, I wish I didn't pay a ton of money up front and have literally nothing uncovered, only to find out that there literally was stuff to uncover. So we're like, all right, well, I would have wanted an audit where I only pay if actually vulnerabilities are uncovered, right? Like, I would gladly pay to uncover the vulnerability that ended up like having us like scrambling on a Zoom call, sweating hard, trying to rescue funds, right? I would have gladly paid to get that found, right? So when we decided to get in, we're like, yeah, let's make a risk-free offer, which is exactly what we would have wanted, is the paper vulnerability offer. It's like, hey, if, you know, just give us like a small amount up front, and literally only pay more if we actually uncover stuff for you.
So that's just what we did. Recap on that a little bit. The paper vulnerability model is basically you take a small fee upfront, and then you're paid per finding after that.
Yeah, and it's sort of grown, and like we've added, you know, mechanisms to it as we've sort of encountered issues along the way, or not even issues, just things that come up, right? So first of all, it's a great way to, like, if you're starting out even as a solo auditor or you're starting your own firm, fantastic way to just make a better offer than all the other firms, right? Because every other firm is going to be, it's a fixed flat cost. Compare that to your offer, which is, okay, just, you know, basically put down this small amount just to reserve the spot and only pay us if we actually find stuff. That's point number one. That's a great offer. You're going to be more likely to win business that way. But then second of all, like, obviously it was just, it sort of incentivized us to actually want to uncover these vulnerabilities, right? Instead of like, okay, we got the money. Now I kind of just want to get this over with, right? So now we actually have kind of gamified it, right? And it's kind of changed throughout as you get more credibility, you don't have to make as good of an offer to still win deals. So we've raised the down payment so that it's more like split 50-50, so that usually 50% of the money for the audit will come from the down payment up front, and then usually 50% will come from the PPV fees. And then we've implemented like a cap or something that can be agreed on ahead of time, because sometimes some code bases just happen to have 20 critical vulnerabilities and those audits can come out very expensive.
Yeah, that makes sense. So how does it work from when a project reaches out to you saying we're interested in this kind of audit until the report is finalized? So how do you do the scoping? How do you do the auditing? How do you assess the severity, communicate the project? Yep. There's a lot of layers that are quite different in your model than a traditional auditing model. So what are the main differences points, and how do you handle it?
Oh man, we're doing an advertisement.
I'm just curious, you know.
All right. So first of all, no, 100%. So, first of all, obviously we'll reach out. We want to make sure obviously that the timeline is right. I mean, this is going to be the same with all firms. It's just making sure that we can actually do the work. That's another whole gripe I have about the service in general, is that it's really hard to schedule and get everything, but you know, that's a whole other issue. But so reach out, figure out if the timeline's right, if it's something that, you know, we think we'd be a good fit for, then yeah, we go ahead with it. We'll basically scope out your contracts based upon the SLOC. So we have a script that will just basically run, and it will normalize all the Solidity code, spit out a number of like, here's a source count, here's basically how many lines of code are actually going to be in scope for the engagement. Based on that, we determine what the down payment is, and that we just have like a formula that basically computes that. And then that's the down payment that just goes in to reserve the spot. And then from there, we just have a set rates for critical, high, medium, low. Currently, what we're running with is $5,000 per critical, I think $2,500 for high, and then $1,000 for medium. And that's just what we've worked our way up to over the last 2 years. Those are the same for any code base that hasn't been previously reviewed. If it went through a Code 4 Arena contest or something before we're reviewing it, then we just double that price, right? I think I got a train running by here. So that's how we scope it out. And then in terms of the actual engagement, honestly, it's an audit still. The only difference is that now we get really excited when we find vulnerabilities, right? Because that means we make money. It's been sort of gamified, and we get to basically add more to the fee when we find that stuff. So one thing that I don't know if other firms are doing, but it's something we found is really helpful, is we share a database of the findings with them in real time. So as stuff comes up, then you're able to see exactly what comes up and fix that, and we can have a discussion about it in real time, instead of what my experience was we got the audit, we waited like a few weeks, then you get the report, you heard nothing for the few weeks, you're like, I don't know if they're finding stuff, I don't know if they're not, and then on the final day you get the whole report, and then you go and you fix stuff if there's anything uncovered. There always usually is if it's a good firm, but That's something we found that's helpful for folks to
Right.
you know,
So
do stuff
when you're doing
faster.
the scope, you said that you have a formula that you use to come up with the down payment. How is the formula like?
Yep. Used to be a little bit more complex. We used to be like, okay, there's a stepwise function, which is like, okay, if it's under 1,000 slok, then it's just 15,000. But if it's over, then we have this rate. I just deleted all that, and
Right,
it's
and
just
that's it. So
$15
you
per
don't really
slok.
take into account the complexity of the code base. It's just more like a very high level review of number of lines of code.
Yeah, I mean, we could definitely like engineer it more. In my opinion, we just keep it simple, and that's worked for us thus
Yeah,
far.
I
But
guess.
yeah.
Yeah.
And it is normalized slok. It's not like just straight up lines of like in a contract, right? So it's the, I think it's consensus. I think they made the package that like normalizes all the slok and stuff like that. So it is like somewhat like, you know, good at like cleaning up all the extra lines and stuff like that. But there's definitely, I agree, 1,000 slok is not always equal to 1,000 slok, but
Yeah, I mean,
I
there's
just kept it
something
simple.
definitely good
Yeah.
about simplicity. You know, it's there's no mental overhead, and I think it
Yeah.
just ends up being a better deal for complex projects at the end of the day. So if you have a complex project, maybe give them a call. You might get a good deal.
Yeah, hit
And
me
you
up.
said that,
Yeah.
what?
That's our specialty, though, because we'll find more vulnerabilities.
And you said that if the firm, the project has a past audit from someone like Code Arena, you charge more. Do you have
Yep.
a certain, you have like a list of past audits? I mean, do you have a list of firms that you considered to raise the price? Or like a list of firms that you don't really like account for, like don't name any
If it's a
names,
Certic
but
audit,
you know,
you're good.
is something that you take into account, or is just like any past audit, or is just like contests? How do you go about doing that?
Yeah. There's, I mean, I would agree. There's definitely a spectrum to it. Generally speaking, if it's obviously if it's a contest or anything like that. If it was another firm review or anything like that, then yeah, that's what we will raise the price based on that. We haven't had any code that was like previously reviewed by a solo auditor. That's a good question. Probably something to think about. I don't know if it should be risen just based on that. I mean, I guess I'd have to look at who the solo auditor is. But when that situation arises, it might be something to think about. Yeah.
And let's say you do the audit. And you found a few vulnerabilities, but some of them are in the kind of like gray area. Is it a medium? Is it a high? Is it a critical? It's you know, not so clear cut sometimes. How do you go about just discussing with the client which of these you should land on?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, this is probably, I would say, the number one like contention to the model is if you don't want to sometimes have resistance when you're classifying vulnerabilities, right? Because the incentive is lined up such that if I put up a critical, the client is incentivized to technically like argue that down. Now, for that, I would say, first of all, you want to work with the right folks who are like going to be generous and they're going to understand like, hey, this is the model. And they're not here to argue. So I will say that there are some clients that we've worked with that we've never had issues with. Actually, most, like from our experience, like just work with the right people, it's actually not going to be an issue. But of course, there's always going to be those exceptions, right? So how do we deal with it in those exceptional cases? Of course, first of all, what we do, you can go and look at any of our reports. In the vast majority of cases, we'll always put like a POC on a critical or a high finding, something that's higher impact. If a POC is like relevant, always come with a code POC that like sufficiently illustrates the full extent of the issue. Just because we are, when we put up that critical, we're putting up a fee with that, right? So there had better be really good reasoning and strong reasoning for that. And so first of all, obviously it's POCing and having really strong descriptions that explicate the full extent of what could go wrong here. That resolves a lot of the gray area of like, okay, let's figure out what the worst case scenario is, and then we can basically, you know, go from there. Obviously, it's also based upon, let's get straight about what the definition of a critical high and medium and low is, which is hard. It's, you know, somewhat subjective, but at the end of the day, you've just got to come to an agreement on that. And sometimes, you know, there will be a disagreement and the client will be like, I think this high is really more of a medium. And, you know, sometimes there's really no clear answer. And a lot of times, like, we'll just say, you know what, like, I'm not really here to just make as much money in as little time as possible. I care about our relationship and I can see the argument for medium. Personally, I would say high, but you know, we'll just go to medium to honor that. And that's fine. Sometimes that's just, you know, how you've got to carry yourself when you're, you know,
yeah, there's definitely people, some pros and cons when it comes to this type of auditing model. Maybe you can dive a little bit more into that. So what do you say are the pros of this model? So things that, you know, where it really shines.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it really shines for anybody trying to get started out who is maybe having trouble getting that inbound demand, or maybe you have that inbound demand, you're just having trouble converting those into actual clients because they're like, well, I got this other offer from XYZ firm or something like this. So they came in a little bit lower. Everybody else is charging a net cost, right? If you come in and you charge pay per vulnerability, the risk is entirely reversed. It's like, well, if this guy doesn't perform, then I don't have to worry about it. I'm literally going to get a really cheap audit. So if you're newer, if you don't have the credibility, if you're trying to build up your portfolio, absolutely, this is what you should do. And also if you're like getting bored of auditing, I talked to some auditors who are like, they can get the deals and they can close the deals at like a fixed price, but they're just they're kind of getting bored of auditing because it's like, oh man, it's just kind of a grind. So I would say also it just makes it more fun, like being able to audit a code base and know that, yeah, if I get a legit high or a legit critical, I'm going to get some money immediately out of that. So yeah, I would say those are the two like really positive things about it, stuff that I've really enjoyed. Now, of course, the downsides, like we discussed, you've got that point of contention with the client with, you know, discussing, is this really critical? Is this really a high? Stuff like that. And then I would say also scalability. So audit firms in general, I think, are just not very scalable just by the nature of the service, because, you know, when you build an agency, ideally what you want to have for the service is something that can be easily replicable across, you know, any client you bring on, right? So I don't really know how a marketing agency works, but I imagine that any client that comes into a marketing agency, you can kind of like copy paste the same sort of, like, if you really focus in on, I'm a marketing agency for people selling pens on Shopify. Well, you can just copy and paste all the creatives and, like, you know, just kind of like, oh, we got a new client. Okay, copy paste, right? I can't do that if I got an options protocol and then now we're getting some perpetuals protocol and we've got to have our auditors like go in and manually review that. That's not a scalable service, right? So on top of that, the PPV model adds complexity where it's like, okay, now I've got to make sure that, you know, if I'm building out a team, we incentivize it the right way so that people don't feel like they're battling against each other within the team to get the reward for the finding or stuff like this. You got to figure out, okay, how much should the base amount be for every researcher on the team? Stuff like that, which is solvable. It just adds complexity to the system. It's not nearly as straightforward. And then you've still got to deal with, you know, if there are issues discussing classification with the client and stuff like that. It doesn't scale as well as maybe just charging a flat amount up front. But I'll say that audits don't really scale in general anyways, in my opinion.
Yeah, so, I think yeah, that's I'd say a good those point that audits are not a very scalable service in the first place. And in a way, the paper vulnerability model just makes that even harder. So, yeah.
Yeah, it does.
I think there's a I wonder how much of the overhead comes from like discussing with clients over severity. Do you think that involves a lot of hours if the client's not very aligned, or is it more like a agree disagree kind of discussion?
Yeah, it's never really been much of the discussion at all. Like, I would say honestly, like maybe 1 to 2% of the time, like maybe like some amount of basis points of the time, to be honest. Like, it's not really a huge overhead. I would say honestly, the most interesting part is the incentives within the team, is like making sure that, yeah, there's not, because there is, and we've sort of played around with, could there be like a shared pot or something like this for the team? But that's an interesting point. It's like, how do you build a team around people doing PPV stuff? Which I think it still works, and it actually works in some cases better because they have that incentive to uncover findings, compared to if I'm just on salary, this is just work that I'm given. I'm not really excited about getting the next critical. I mean, it's great to get a critical, but $5,000 is great too.
Yeah,
So.
that's something that I think is probably one of the worst downsides of the PPV model, that there's not much of a, like, it's a bit of a paradox because there's not much of an incentive for the auditors to go down deep those rabbit holes that have a very low percentage of being fruitful, but every now and then you find something. So it might just be that, you know, if you just had a flat fee, you wouldn't have a problem digging down those trenches and trying to see if there's something really there. But with the PPV model, there's literally zero incentive. You wanna just try to look for, you know, the things that have the highest likelihood to give you that critical that you're looking for. So in that sense, I think it makes it definitely not like a one in, I'm not sure how to phrase it. Like, in my opinion, because of those things, it's probably not the kind of audit that you want to have. It's not like the only kind of model that you should go for. And I wonder what's your opinion on that. Do you think that if you go for a few rounds of PPV, it's good enough to like be sufficient to deploy to mainnet, or do you think there should be other types of models in addition to PPV?
Yeah, I think so. I would actually disagree. I would say that there's a number of cases where we were on, like, the last couple of days of an audit, but since we really want to get the fees up, and like we want to get paid, my co-founder, he just keeps looking. He won't give up, and like, lo and behold, on literally the last week or the last few days, something is uncovered that is like really deep and niche, and it could have gotten by if we were like, all right, well, we've done our due diligence here. If we had just gotten paid up front, we're like, all right, well, there's no ROI for us to continue. We've done the due diligence, we put in the time, why continue? We've already convinced ourselves of the security of this code base, we're good, right? So I would actually say that if you just take a flat fee up front, you're not gonna, you have no incentive to continue. Right, you have a, I feel responsible for this code base because I'm putting my name on it. That is an incentive, right? But that's not something that's going to keep you literally coming back for more. We also have that incentive, right? We take a down payment up front. We put our name on every single report that we put out, on every code base that we put out. And, so we have both of those incentives, but I think that the literally lining up the money to the findings being uncovered, I think that personally, I think that's more powerful for results. And yeah, I think you could put any code base through multiple rounds of a PPV audit and have it be, really solid. And I think the GMX V2 code base would stand a testament to that. I challenge anybody to go have a look at that after 6 rounds of a PPV review and try to find something in the 15,000 lines of solidity there. And
Shots being
I'll be
fired.
surprised if you can.
You're really putting on a bounty on your head right now. And do you guys
Yeah,
have like
let's do it.
how does it work with timelines? Is it sort of kind of like we're gonna work on this until we really cannot figure something else? Or is it more traditionally time bound, like a regular audit?
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic point. And it's something that I think I agree, the point that you had about like, hey, we have to change the way that the industry like approaches this, because you can't just get one audit and be like, okay, we're good, right? So the way that I've thought about this is, if we have a review and we uncover, sometimes we uncover like 14 critical vulnerabilities and all like valid issues that are like would cause extreme detriment to the protocol, that's obviously something that needs to get another audit, right? So my sort of my thesis on how do we reach good smart contract security or acceptable smart contract security is we need to go through multiple rounds of an audit until you reach that point where an entire team of security researchers has been correctly incentivized to dig deep into the protocol and uncover critical vulnerabilities, but they just failed to do so, right? So what does that look like? That looks like, you know, for several teams, what we've done is we continue to do reviews until like the first time there's like six critical vulnerabilities. The second time there might be one or two critical vulnerabilities with like a high or something like that. And then the final round, we're like, yeah, we banged our head against this thing for 3 weeks and we really wanted to get the PPV fees. We couldn't find a thing. You got a clean report with like a bunch of lows, maybe a couple of mediums. Then you're good to go. That's where you have the confidence. And that's how you can measure the security of a protocol, is how much time and effort was put in to uncover vulnerabilities in this thing compared to how many vulnerabilities were uncovered, right? That ratio is our proxy for how secure is this thing. It's not 100% like guaranteed, but in my opinion, that's the best way we have of measuring how secure is this thing.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things that's definitely a good way to go about it. Do you, for the different rounds, you obviously would have like a specific timeline, right? And makes you decide, like at what point do you kind of tell yourself like, okay, this is enough?
Yeah. There is no like, okay, and that kind of feeds into the fact that, yeah, we don't know how to literally measure the security of something. So it's like, it's hard. The end of an audit is hard. And it's kind of a feeling that you get. And the feeling is really depression. It's when you're looking at a code base and you cannot break it. You fully understand everything. You've been over thing 15 times and you're just trying to figure out new perspectives. You've been trying new things like mob auditing or just trying different wacky stuff. You're looking at the code upside down and all this crazy stuff, and you can't find anything new, and you've been just hitting your head up against it for weeks. That's when it's time to say like, yeah, I think the engagement is over. Here's what we found. Here's a summary of the engagement. Yeah. So, I mean, there's no real magical formula. It's more of like, you know, you go until it starts to really hurt. And then
do you think those engagements can be quite long, you develop some sort of bias and that kind of ends up hurting you in some way along the line?
Yeah, that's a huge issue, is like getting those blinders, right? So if you spend a ton of time on a code base, you start to basically become the developer, right? Like the developer can't really audit their own code because they have all these assumptions and, you know, they just look at it a different way. And yeah, once you start to know code base too well, then it's like, yeah, well, I've looked at this 15 times, so I already have trust in it. Subconsciously, I'm not going to be thinking in like a really skeptical mindset of every line, because I'm like, oh yeah, that's that. So one thing to combat that I've noticed is really helpful is bringing on new folks who are just completely new to the code base in subsequent reviews. So we had a number of, you know, new people come on, and we would basically like, we would onboard them, we would give them, you know, the kickoff call to basically go over the whole system and then walk through them, get their understanding up to speed, and then they have the fresh eyes, right? And it's almost like the rubber ducky approach as well, because we're explaining our assumptions and stuff in real time. And sometimes I'd be like, oh, wait, I should probably look into that while I was like explaining it. So, yeah, 100%. That's something that you could get trapped in.
And it's a hard problem to solve. Something that makes me question a little bit the PPV model sometimes is that, in a way, it's just a bug bounty in disguise, right? It's like a, in a way, like a cheap version of bug bounty. So why wouldn't a project just launch a bug bounty really early with like a, you know, certain amount of funds and pay an incentive to a few researchers and have that instead of going through a firm and doing it that way?
Yeah, I mean, they could do that. You could do whatever you want. Or you could get an audit from us and you could do the PPV approach if that's what you want. Yeah, you could do that.
Better, worse, like pros and cons again from doing like the bug bounty approach or doing a PPV firm approach? Why do you think one project would choose one other than the other?
Yeah, I think first of all, I mean, if people want to do that, I would say, first of all, it's like, how do I find the platform to do that on? I know ImmuneFi is kind of like deployed code bases. Maybe you could, you know, figure out something there. Or I know there are contest platforms. I think Hats, I don't know if they would do something similar to that. I'm not as familiar with their setup. But first of all, it'd be like finding, okay, where can I do that? What's the right platform? Second of all, when you just throw up a bunch of money and you're like, hey, come and look at this thing, you're going to get very surface level, like, you don't have a team that's dedicated to the engagement, right? And that's, and there's no real name backing it. You have like, okay, we threw up this amount of money and we were like, hey guys, come and hack this. And that's the security review, right? Versus we engaged an actual team. They were incentivized partially by PPV. They also had a flat amount and, you know, they're putting their name on this thing. They're putting their effort behind this. And so, you know, there are, it seems like it's basically on a spectrum of like, there's the firm complete, like, we're just going to have a team look at this. And then there's the, let's just throw up like, you know, X amount of money and have a bunch of people crowdsource look at this. We're kind of in the middle where we're like a firm who will be incentivized for what we uncover, right? The people who are, you're still going to get the trained people who have researched these protocols for the last 2.5-3 years, and they've really, you know, this is what they do, and you know, you're still going to get the full report and the recommendations on all the low stuff, and you know,
I agree with you on that one, that it's having that level of commitment guaranteed is definitely a plus for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we've been talking about a lot of intricacies of the PPV model. So what kind of projects do you think that this is for, and what kind of projects do you think it is not for, in the sense of the stage of the project, the size of the project, the complexity? Because in my opinion, it's not a service lends itself well to every kind of project. So in, coming from you, what do you think would be the ideal, and who is it not for?
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, coming from me, it's ideal for you if you think you have 30 critical vulnerabilities and you want to pay us a ton of money. No. But yeah, I think definitely there is a trade-off of like, if you come up with, you know, if you're going to do an engagement for one of those really skilled teams, like if we were going to do an audit for Aave, then we're probably not going to find a ton of critical vulnerabilities, right? So they're probably going to get a really good deal. On the other hand, I'd love to do an audit for Aave. I'd love to get their name in our portfolio. So we might be fine with that. But I would say definitely for the projects that are just launching and maybe you have a newer team of devs, maybe consider getting like some, you know, a solo auditor review or something like that before you went into one of these. And I mean, depending on the person that you got a PPV review from, maybe that would change the rates for PPV. Personally, if a solo auditor reviewed the code in scope, I think we would be fine with that, because honestly, a lot of the code bases that we have a look at that are from newer teams, and are being reviewed like by a firm for the first time, they have so many vulnerabilities. This is why we ended up setting a cap where it's like, okay, what is the most that we can hit? And then like, let's agree on that first so we don't have any issues, some, you know, something like unsuspected comes up. And so we, with newer teams, will almost always go ahead and just hit the cap, right? So I think definitely if you're going to do a PPV audit and you do it with somebody other than us, make sure there's a cap set ahead of time if you're a newer team, for sure. And then beyond that, like maybe get a solo auditor. I think solo auditors are great. And if you don't hit the cap, then that's great. That means that you're probably getting closer to getting ready to
launch.
So when
you say a cap, does it mean that once you hit that cap, you stop looking for bugs, or does it mean that you don't charge anymore for the bugs that you find?
Yeah, so it's definitely a tough one. Personally, what we do is we don't charge any more than that. We always try to finish up the engagement. Of course, if we hit the cap on like the second day of the engagement, then that's going to be an issue, right? There's fundamental issues with the code base. We haven't run into anything like that, but usually what we try to do is we try to like, okay, we want to get this engagement wrapped up. We're already charging more than enough. So, you know, we're already fully invested. We want to help this team get as far as they can go. But I will say always, always, if we hit the cap, that means there has to be another review regardless, because, you know, we talk about this idea of measuring security for smart contracts. If we hit the cap, that means we uncovered like 8 critical vulnerabilities or something like that, which means you're not launching with a report that has 8 critical vulnerabilities on it. Like, if there's 8 critical vulnerabilities, there's probably 9, I'm going to be honest. So always, no matter what, there should be another report until you get a report that has like maybe 1 critical vulnerability at most.
So the cap is
right.
More like a signal that you need another round.
Yeah, and I mean really that's the same with every audit, right? With any audit, if you get more than like, in my opinion, like 3 or 4 plus like high impact vulnerabilities, there should probably be another audit if you want to sleep at night.
Yeah, no,
right?
I agree with
at
that.
Least personally.
I think, you know, it's the sort of thing that if there is a certain number of criticals, it's likely that there's more.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because most of engagements are really time bound and people can only uncover so much during that period. Mm-hmm. It's definitely wise to keep a look on that ratio of how many criticals or highs you have, and even mediums as well. Like a lot of mediums,
yeah,
they can pile up and become something really nasty.
Yep.
And this subject of, you know, having a cap, it's tricky in a way that people with not the best intentions could end up using PPV in the wrong way, as in just looking for projects that are more likely to be riddled with bugs rather than trying to work with more impactful projects, like you joked as well.
Yeah.
And how do you advise projects to kind of select someone that they're confident to work with? You know, maybe they don't have the budget to go through your services, but they're still interested in going for the model. How can they differentiate a guy that's going to just, you know, go take them for a ride, or someone that's going to be kind of like more mindful and set up like a respectful cap or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I would say also, first of all, if you are trying to turn to the dark side and you're trying to do PPV and just work with like newer projects, I'd say you're shooting yourself in the foot if you don't work with those more established projects, because if you do work with them, even though you might not get paid amazingly, if you don't find a ton of vulnerabilities, you're going to get that brand, that reputation associated with you in your portfolio, which is going to make you way more down the road. So that's my first advice for anybody trying to go to the dark side there. Now for teams who want to, you know, they want to make sure that whoever's doing this PPV approach, you want to protect yourself. You want to make sure you're actually getting like a good deal. Nobody's going to like hose you and try to tell you that like a sequencer uptime check is a critical vulnerability or something like this. Right. So, I mean, have them take a personality test. I don't know. But yeah, I would definitely say if you are going into a PPV engagement, make sure that there is some form of contract, some form of agreement that outlines like, yeah, this is what we expect. I think a lot of people in the crypto space are a little more like loosey-goosey with the agreements. It's kind of like handshake agreements. But certainly make sure there's a contract so everybody's expectations is in line and you have a cap in writing where it's like, yeah, we're not going to go over this amount. And that will just make everything a lot easier.
How do you do your agreement? Would you be open to share it? Mm-hmm. Like I can share in the description so projects have a baseline that they can kind of try to work with or ask from whatever auditor is collaborating with them?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. We could send over our base agreement and, yeah, include it in the description. I would say the most important parts of the agreement for us is, first of all, like, it's nothing special. It's basically a template, but we have made sure that certain important things are in there. Firstly, obviously the agreement of what are the rates per critical, high, medium, low, etc. We just do lows for free. But, and then, of course, if there's a cap, that's in there, of course, stuff like that. Another thing that's important for the auditor is an indemnification clause. So I don't think there have been any, like, lawsuits or anything yet, but I do think that there some firms, there might be grounds for legal action. I'll leave it at that. But it's always better to have that as a safety net, as just like we have an agreement with an indemnification clause that says, hey, we tried our best, but you can't come after us for everything we're worth. If, you know, there is some, you know, everybody misses something, this is the business that we're in, right? So that's the third important thing. And
we cool. can put that in the description. To, yeah. to a lot of projects and also to a lot of researchers that might be looking to do something like that as well.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that it's something that's kind of hard to scale. We touched on that before. So I was more interested in mm-hmm. how do you mm-hmm. compensate your either collaborators or employees, because it's not like you have a set rate, right? It depends on how many criticals you find. So
yeah.
How does that work? Do you get like a full-time employee? Is it more just like contractors? How are you guys setting this up at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a tough problem to solve, and there's a lot of different ways you could address it with the PPV model, right? Because you can sort of structure the incentives however you want them to be. So what we've came to thus far, at least, I mean, we're certainly open to iterating further, is when folks are on an engagement, they should have a base weekly amount that is, you know, depending on their skill level or, you know, whatever the agreed contract is, a base weekly amount. And so that's to make sure that, like, yes, you're going to get paid even if you don't find stuff, right? We don't want to have a situation where it's like you don't find anything, you don't make any money from the time that you spent. So there's a base amount, and then on top of that you'll get a portion of the PPV rewards that, you know, for the findings that you get, that's how you get rewarded there. And so it's a nice way of having the people that work with us, they're still incentivized to uncover the highs and criticals and mediums. And of course, you know, you always want to throw lows on there, though we don't charge for lows, but great way to incentivize them to do that, but still have, you know, like you're going to get paid for your time regardless.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And in regards to not charging for lows, do you ever worry that because you don't really look for lows at all, you're letting some things slip by? You know, it's the famous, like, you know, many lows turn into a high. Do you think that is something that the model doesn't lend itself to well, and those kind of bugs are very likely to slip through?
We are just as incentivized to report lows as traditional firms are.
Traditional firms, they obviously are getting paid a set rate, and those lows are more of a consultative nature, whereas the PPV is more focused, obviously, on the higher issues, which sometimes have low origins, so to speak. So, in my opinion, I don't think the incentives are the same for low features. I think the PPV model definitely has lower incentives for lower issues. Why do you think the incentive is for you is the same for you guys?
Yeah, I'd say that's fair. I think since we've raised the down payment a lot, it's like we are still getting like a pretty sizable amount upfront. So there still is the same sort of like commitment. Definitely, if you are charging, okay, no amount upfront, entirely PPV, you're right. There is like not really like a commitment to like, yeah, I'm gonna report lows and stuff. We still try to report a ton of lows just because well, first of all, it makes the report a lot longer, and you get to spend a ton extra time creating the report, and we
I bet you
love
do.
writing
Yeah,
the
it's
report.
everyone's
No.
favorite part is just writing the long ass report.
I mean, actually, just recently, just a quick note on that, we got an automation to work to just auto-generate it from a Notion database. That's been an absolute blessing for us as of late. So I hope to share that with everybody soon. We've got to get the Python code cleaned up, but that's been absolutely huge. But on the lows, like, yeah, I could see how you would say like, okay, there is technically, if you like dig into it, it's like, yeah, we're accepting an amount upfront, but all of the other like medium high critical, sure, we're accepting payment for that. We're not getting paid for the lows. I would say if there is a case where a ton of lows can turn into a high, well, we're going to explore that because we want to get the high, right? So, definitely, we do still look for those. And then, in terms of just reporting all of the lows, yeah, I mean, okay, I'll say this. If you are a client, you're looking for an audit report and you want to get a ton of lows, go work with somebody else if
Yeah,
that's what you're looking
fair
for.
enough. And switching gears a little bit, speaking of lows and having a lot of low findings, you just recently put out a beginner's course, or maybe not even a beginner's, like a overall auditing course a few days ago, I think. So what is your motivation behind releasing this public course?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, first of all, I mean, I've been putting out the videos for, it's been almost a year now. It's really to, first of all, I think like building, you know, a recognizable like name in the space is not something that we'll see like an immediate effective gain from just doing it. Like we haven't, I have like CTAs at the end of my videos, like, hey, if you need an audit, then like apply here. We don't get any audits through that. It's all through our network. So, I mean, there's no like direct, like, this is why we've been releasing these videos, but I just think that it's beneficial to build up like a network and a name in the space. That's something that helps me do it, and also like to be able to like provide this education because it's really hard to find auditors who know this. So I'd love more people to get really good so we can work with them, right? And then that sort of solves the problem of the other reason why audit firms are hard to scale, which is we literally can't find people who we trust to take on these code bases, which is why, you know, myself and my co-founder are still very much in the weeds. Maybe that's, you know, a mindset blocker that we have. But yeah, regardless, I think it's great anything that you could do to benefit folks and allow anybody to learn this stuff, because I think anybody can learn this. It just takes a ton of an immense amount of work, but I think the knowledge should not be anything that keeps folks back. And then, of course, recently with the launch of the course, I think we just announced the gateway sort of program, and that's going to be a way for, of course, you can come and you can get all the free resources, you can get all the free knowledge, everything you need to know. That is all free. That is all out there. Anybody can come in and learn this stuff. For those subset of folks that want a more hands-on approach, they want to go through a full boot camp and they want to learn from lead auditors who have actually been doing this, or sorry, lead security researchers. Gotta correct myself. But then you can do that if that's something that you want to do. And that is a way to make this, the content sort of sustainable, where it's like, we can provide the free content to everybody and we can actually, you know, keep the lights on and keep that thing going. I think anything that is providing a good to the community should have some sort of, you know, symbiosis where it's like, yeah, we can keep it alive and there's actually like a way to sustain it, but it still has all these positive externalities that anybody can benefit.
What's your take on the security review versus audit?
I do think that a change in language is, you know, helpful. Like we talk about changing the approach from like, oh, I got my singular audit to this went through a multiple rounds of security reviews, right? So I think the language change is fundamental to that.
It just sounds
sadly
so much
audit is five letters. Yeah, it's five letters and security review is a lot more than that. So when it comes to writing headlines, when it comes to writing tweets, especially, the fact that crypto is on Twitter is like a huge barrier to adoption of security review because you're not going to get it in the character count, right? So I think audits, to be honest, is probably going to stick around and I'm probably going to continue to say it. I'm sorry. I apologize to everybody, but it's going to slip. I definitely do like write stuff and like correct it, go back and like say, revise that to security review. But yeah, I think a change of language is good, but audit is better to just be able to just quickly
say. Yeah, I think if we talk about it enough, eventually people are going to know what we mean when we say audit. You know, we actually mean security review. So that's why I try to bring it up with as many people as I can, because hopefully if you talk about it enough, it's going to sink in and then people are just going to know what we mean. But going back to the motivation behind the course, I'm curious to know how long did it take for you to do that? And not really how long, but how was the process of doing that? How did your approach of creating this course in general?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So what we did is for basically recording all the content for it, I guess technically all of the content that's in the actual course took me the last year, just because some of those things are like overviews of like reentrancy and, you know, like flash loan attacks and like Oracle manipulation and all the stuff that I've been recording over the past year. But really the bulk of the course has been what I did in a span of 4 weeks, which was take a handful of security researchers, worked with six security researchers over 4 weeks, basically gave them the training that I think any security researcher should have, like advanced training, and then just recorded every single lecture, every single session that we had. And then that's what ultimately became the content for this course. And then, you know, just it's a matter of me sitting down, splicing all that stuff together, and then releasing it for everybody.
Can you give us a overview of how that training session was like? What do you think it should be?
Yeah, no, 100%. So one of the things that was probably a different approach than you might think is we started out developing, right? And that's not because these people didn't know how, like what Solidity was, or they didn't know how to develop. It was more because I feel that the best way to understand these like DeFi concepts and some of these more complex protocols at a deep level is to go through and from first principles, think through, okay, this is what I have to achieve. This is the point of this DeFi protocol. How do I code something that does that in Solidity? And so it's more about understanding the DeFi concepts from first principles, because now when I go into an audit with that knowledge of like, hey, I literally built one of these, right? So I understand this type of protocol inside and out. Now you go into an audit and it's a lot more approachable. I know exactly where to look. I know that, hey, when I'm going into the perpetualist protocol, I know there's going to be a function to calculate the P&L of a position. I know there's going to be probably, there's going to be a ton of edge cases in the decrease logic. I should probably focus in on the decrease logic. Hey, what if a position is insolvent? Is there an issue with liquidations for insolvent positions? Do they handle if tokens are, if an address is blacklisted and maybe you can't liquidate somebody because of that? All these different things that you run into when you're like creating your own protocol that just gives you the inside scoop on these. So that's probably the biggest difference from what folks might expect, is we didn't just dive straight into security. We started out with how do we understand DeFi from first principles. And then we moved into more like auditing approach, applying what we've just learned into actually going through and hands-on auditing and getting the feedback loop. One of the things I see right now is a lot of folks, they go into C4, they go into Sherlock, they go into CodeHawks now, and you compete in a contest, and the first contest, you know, a lot of folks will get like, you know, some lows and mediums. Second contest, they get some lows and mediums, or, you know, maybe just one medium, one or two mediums, stuff like this. And they never really get like anything crazy, and they just kind of consistently like flatline. They can't really break out of it. I see a lot of people there right now. And to me, that's like a perfect diagnosis of there's something wrong with your feedback loop, right? It's where if you had a really good feedback loop, the first contest you do, you'd get maybe some gas optimization, stuff like that. Next contest, you would jump up to, hey, I got a couple of mediums and lows. Next one, you'd be like, hey, I got my first high, stuff like this. And then the next one after that, you know, you're off to the races, and then it's just all downhill from there. So I think that's really the second part, is we understand DeFi. We understand the base concepts from first principles. We're comfortable with this more advanced stuff. Now, how do we get the right feedback loop in place? And, you know, I think the key to doing that is to, if you're able to pair up with somebody else who's perhaps a little bit ahead of you, they know where you need to be improving on, they can give you those insights, then I think that's a fantastic way to do that. But really a combination of those two things, that's what the bootcamp was.
Yeah, I agree.
Really,
I think the feedback loop is definitely the way to improve. And the shorter you can make it and the more interactive you can make it, the better it is. Obviously, most people don't have access to someone that's really in a position to take them to the next level, right? A lot of the beginners are just solo trying to improve. And for those people that don't have access to more experienced security researchers, I think your best bet is going to like Code Arena and getting that backstage pass and just going through the other people's findings. Yep. Literally read everyone's findings, see everything that you missed. That's gonna take a lot of time, but that's the only way you're actually gonna close the feedback loop, and it's the best way to progress. Is like, I think that's the key. You know, a lot of people, they want to know how you do it, like what is the mindset, what is the way you should approach things, and all those things can be really subjective, even though there's like a common line of like trying to, you know, have a bird's eye view and then diving deep into the code. But ultimately people are going to do things in whatever makes sense for them. And the only way to figure out what makes sense for you is to go for the feedback loop.
100%. And I would even say, like, not only that, but also get a partner. Find somebody who you can partner up with, because that is feedback loop in real time. And it's like you can see exactly how somebody else is approaching the code base. They don't have to be like, you know, eons ahead of you, but just somebody who's even on your same skill level that you can audit with. That's just going to make the whole experience way, way easier. And another thing, just on, you know, reading findings and stuff like that, personally, I've always felt that like reading reports or reading individual findings on like Solana or stuff like this, I think it's a fantastic tool and a great way to have like a database for findings, stuff like that. It's almost like flashcards for auditing, but auditing isn't really something you memorize, right? So personally, I found that, you know, a lot of folks are spending a lot of time reading reports, reading findings, things like that. You gotta spend more time just actually doing it, right? You can't just study for this. It's not a quiz in biology in middle school, right? This is like, you gotta change the way that you think, not the specific things that you think, right? It's not a pattern match game. It's a mindset game. And really, I think the only way to change that is by working with somebody, if you can get a partner, or if you can get some sort of mentor, you know, reach out to somebody ahead of you, you know, some of the big people in the space. that's what's going to change your mindset, and that's what's going to give you the unlock and, you know, ultimately get you
definitely
going.
Definitely one of the biggest pitfalls. People get kind of obsessed with just report reading, which is kind of like a way to that makes you feel productive, but it's not really helping you in a significant way, because you really need the context of the code base for reading those reports to be impactful. If you really want to improve, you need the context, and there's no way you're going to get that unless you do the audit yourself.
Yeah, 100%. And then you see, and even it's like the, there's the literal sense of, I did this audit, here are the findings that I missed, and then you can sort of read the findings, but then you have to work back from that finding to, because you can't just say like, oh, when I see XYZ line of code, put this finding, right? You have to work backwards from that and be like, oh, what area of the code base should I have really focused on? What type of questions should I have been asking, and what headspace did I need to be in to be able to put myself in a position to get that, right? And that's the hardest part, because it's like, you can't just read a finding and then get that, right? You've got to either think really deeply about it and, you know, have some sort of light bulb moment there, or work with a partner, see how they're approaching stuff, and, you know, see stuff that way. Yeah.
And when you're doing these PPV audits, from my perspective, they tend to be of a longer duration, especially if you have multiple rounds. So what is your auditing methodology on the first round? How is it on the second round? And how does that progress over time?
Yeah, so on the first round, or I mean, really even, I think it's also interesting to talk about just intra audit, like in the same audit, it kind of changes throughout as we continue through the code base. So obviously when we're first starting, I like to call it like the fog of a code base. So when you're first opening it, you can't really see like 3 feet in front of your face. You just kind of have to like work through each line of code and be like, huh, okay, I'm gonna understand that eventually. But so as you dig through, I like to try to cover as much ground as possible within the first like 2 hours or something like that, and just see like, what's going on here? What is the full extent of what the geometry of this code base even looks like, right? And then one thing that's really helpful in that period of time is maybe diagramming it out if it's something that has a lot of contracts, stuff like this. Then once I've got that down, now it's time to walk through some actual like user flows of like, okay, if it's something where you can create a position, how do you do that? How do you put in collateral? How do you actually get the position saved in storage somewhere, et cetera, et cetera? I know you've got to decrease the position. Let's walk through that. Let's understand that. There's got to be liquidations or something like this. Let's understand that. And it's just go boom, 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 boom. Each feature of the protocol, I just want to walk through and understand it at a high level first. And then once I have a general grasp on that, now go through and I can basically look at a deeper level. And on the second, third pass, that's usually when I start to think about issues coming up. I don't even try to think about vulnerabilities until I understand at least the high level of the code.
Yeah, no, I agree. Yeah. I literally think of it the same way. I think of the first stages of like I call it like the cloudy stage, where everything is just kind of like,
yeah,
you don't really
exactly
know what's going on. And little by little, you kind of go like, you know, unclouding it. Eventually have like a full view of what's going on, and then can really try and brainstorm how to break this thing. So
yeah,
that's more like in the intra audit perspective, right? But when you do a second round, how does that change? Because obviously you have a slight bias from a previous audit and you have less unclouding to do. So how do you approach that?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So one of the biggest problems that we did run into is like, hey, we've reviewed this code base for the last 9 months. How do I get a new perspective, right? So what we started doing actually is we sort of came up with this idea of like mob auditing. So the way that, and I sort of stole this from, I think like mob programming is already, that's already a thing. And it's something that I did briefly when I was working as a software engineer. Didn't really like it as a software engineer. I thought it was, at the time, kind of stupid to have like seven senior engineers on a call, wasting like $4,000 an hour of company time. But it was a great way to learn and like download skill set from those senior engineers. But in terms of efficiency, it's like writing 12 lines of code in an hour that costs like $10,000, not great. But in terms of auditing, we were able to basically like take, you know, three or four team members, hop on a call. Basically, instead of you sitting there auditing on your own, what we've tried is you have one person who's basically like actually sharing their screen. They're walking through the code base. Another person is guiding them through it and saying like, hey, let's look at this interesting edge case. I think that might be an issue, stuff like that. And then the crowd is just there to shout out stuff that they might think of. And then you rotate every 20, 30 minutes, whatever you want to do. And I found that that's a way to just get out of the norm, right? I'm not looking at this code base by myself like I have been for the past however long. Now I'm looking at this code base and somebody's over my shoulder telling me what to do, right? Or somebody's guiding through it on their own. Now I'm calling the shots and I'm saying like, oh, I just literally thought of this new edge case. Let's dig into that a little bit, right? And so it was actually pretty successful in, like, we were able to go over parts of the code base that I had been over several times before, and we were able to see like new edge cases that wouldn't have otherwise come up. So that's definitely a very interesting approach.
So while we're going through the code, who are the people in each position? So for example, who is the person running through the code base? And so I guess in my mind, I think like one person kind of goes through the things and the other one asks the questions. And everyone else is just watching, right? So mm-hmm. I think it should play a huge role. Yep. Who is who? So how do you decide what person has which position?
Yeah, we just start off whatever, you know, if you were walking last time, then I'll walk this time, and then we'll just switch every 30 minutes. So everybody gets to, there's actually an app, it's called like mob.timer or something like that. It's like mobtime.er or something like that that we use.
That's crazy. Yeah.
It's actually built for this. So everybody just rotates and everybody does it.
And do you kind of go through the code base sporadically? Like, let's start here and see where it leads us. Or do you have like a schedule of, okay, these are the parts that we want to cover. We're going to go through these.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great point. I don't think I touched on that earlier as well. It's like, always have a goal, right? So earlier on when I was auditing, you just kind of find yourself like floundering throughout the code base. Not really, you're just kind of aimlessly like looking at stuff, you're just rolling the dice. You're like, what are we going to get today? Right? So definitely a big thing has been, okay, what's my goal for this session? Or what are we trying to do right now? Oftentimes I like to set goals as let's walk through XYZ feature. So we might say like, okay, the goal right now is to walk through decreasing a position and just walk through that. Or the goal right now is to look into this edge case or something like that and basically have that. And then of course, like when I'm auditing on my own, I like to set like, I've got this timer here that like, you know, I just set to like 60 minutes, something like that. I'm going to do this goal. I'm going to sit down for 60 minutes. That's what I'm going to do. That's how I stay basically on track.
Yeah. And I heard you mention that you do something similar, but more on a one-on-one basis with the engineer, just running through the code base and trying to understand it really quickly. So how does that work as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you're auditing yourself,
I think it was you. I'm pretty sure it was you that you have this method where you run through the code base, like it's you and the engineer, and you just kind of have a call to go through the code base and kind of tackle it in a much quicker way.
Yeah. So I think he's the one who tweeted that out, but we do that in sort of like a team way. So the way we like to start off every engagement is with a kickoff call with the team that we're auditing. We like to basically get their developers to brain dump exactly how they're, you know, the architecture, the weird edge cases, the invariants we like to collect, like, okay, what are the invariants or the assumptions that you have that would be catastrophic if they're broken from your perspective? Get those. Those are the things that we'll integrate into the fuzz testing suite that we basically build out for them over the engagement. And then that's a session where you basically get to walk through the code base with the engineers and download their knowledge. But that's like that's a team thing. That's like, we get everybody who's on the engagement on that call.
Okay, cool.
And go
so
through
it's
it with
kind
their
of like
team.
Run through with everyone, kind of like shooting questions and things. And before you go for the call, do you already have a substantial context on the code, or is it like the first time you're kind of looking at it?
Yeah, we found the most productive is for me to already, or for everybody on the team to already have like a few days of already being able to dig in, because otherwise it's just like, I haven't even gotten to look at the code yet. Whatever
you're
saying doesn't make
any
sense.
Yeah, I totally think that makes sense. I'll be surprised if it was like the first call you had without context, because then it doesn't, it's the same thing with like reading reports, right? Like it doesn't really translate into anything to my head.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's definitely the way to go about it. And with all of that in mind, what's your vision for the future of Guardian audits?
I think, so I mean, in line with what we've been talking about as like, you know, audits, they don't scale extremely nicely, or if you do try to scale, you're just kind of taking on more risk with all the work that you do and all the surface area of code that you put out into the universe. So we want to keep it to a small, like really specialized team. We're not looking to go huge with the firm. I think we just want to work with, you know, the right clients that we want to work with, and keep it pretty exclusive. So no plans to go huge there. As far as the gateway program goes, I think that is something that, you know, could potentially grow a lot bigger, with the ultimate vision of being able to train not even just security researchers, which is something we need a lot of right now, but blockchain developers in general who have a security mindset baked into the training that they get. Because I think every blockchain engineer should be in some part a security engineer, just by the nature of what you're working on. So that's a big part of the future that I see for the ecosystem as a whole, is being able to onboard hopefully thousands of blockchain developers, whether that be through the free content that we put out that anybody can go through, tons of like courses and stuff like that, or it be through the boot camp that we do for folks to onboard
into
this space.
Yeah, aspect of onboarding developers in a security mindset perspective is definitely something very important. You know, I mentioned it before with someone that you can't really have a junior Solidity auditor. I mean, a junior Solidity developer, right? Because then everything just gets wrecked. And we need to be able to close that gap as fast as possible.
Yeah.
So that's a really good thing for the industry, I think. And how do you plan 100%. To accomplish all of that? Do you have like a strategy set in place, or you're just kind of like, you know, just more like on the impulsive side, just kind of like let's go and just run for the walls?
Yeah, I mean, of course, we'll see what ends up happening, and you can't predict everything. But of course, right now we're just starting the first official like full cohort of the full program. And really, we're just focused on getting insane results for the people who go through that, and just putting everything we can into that. Because I think if we get that right, then we've got something really good to be able to put folks through, and really get the program right, to be able to get somebody from, you know, having that Solidity knowledge and having that, you know, you understand DeFi, you understand the basics of security and stuff like that. How do we just take somebody from there to be a top level auditor? That's a very hard problem to solve. But if we can solve that, I think that would be absolutely huge for the ecosystem, because those people are in very high demand right now. So really it's solving that problem, focusing on that, and then we can go wider and do bigger things from there.
Yeah, I 100% agree. Yeah. I think if you can solve the problem in a repeatable manner, then you can onboard so many more auditors. It's such a hard skill to pass on.
Yeah.
Right? especially yeah, because 100%. A lot of people, yeah. most people audit in slightly different ways. It's a very challenging problem for sure. So I'm really excited to see how you guys crack down on that, and really excited to see the results you have on in the different iterations and how the whole program evolves over time. And yeah, dude, really keen for that. It's been a pleasure having you here. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, dude, absolutely. Likewise, I had a blast. Thanks for having me on, man.